Blog Talk Radio.
There's a direct relationship between having the businesses and being in prison. Go find an see how many Asians you can find in American prisons. You ain't gonna be in there. But 51% of your prison will be black because blacks don't have any businesses and industries. There's a direct link. Blacks won't practice group economics. Blacks won't practice group politics. If you don't practice, you're setting yourself up. I told that five-story building, you're setting yourself to get wiped out. Understand the nature of race, which is economic. If you build the first floor, it's economic. Build your businesses and your industries. Control business and industry, and put that pulls in your money, and hold that money, and practice group economics with it. Arab and Asian money bounces 12 to 13 times for a lead. Jewish money bounces 18 times. Black folk got to learn how to practice group economics. Black Americans spend every penny they get outside their own community. Then you take the money and the wealth that you get from that first floor and go to the second floor. The second floor is politics. You then take that money on the first floor and you control your politics. Black folk must quit allowing people to tell them to go out and vote. Vote for what? Nobody's going to do anything for black folk in politics. Politics is controlled by money. Major corporations who got the money. That's what controls politics. If you have no money, you have no say-so, you have no benefits coming. So you take your money and you control and you take your money on the first floor, you buy every politician on the second floor. And any politician you can't buy, you rent or lease them to get what you need. Then once you get the second floor under control with the politician, with your money, then you go to the third floor. The third floor then is the police department and the court system. You take your money from the first floor and your politics on the second floor and you control the court system and the police department. Then the fourth floor, then is media. You then take the money that you generate off the first floor from business and industries and you go after radio stations, TV stations, newspapers, and cable systems so that you can now inform and communicate with your own people. Right now, black folk own and control less than 0.035% of the media in the United States. Out of 12,000 radio stations, black folk own about 75 or 80. That's all. You own no cable systems. You don't have a daily newspaper. You have nothing of importance. You got about one black TV station. So you can't communicate with your people. You can't inform your people. You can't do anything. You can have Rush Limbaugh and all the rest of the guys talking about racism all day long and bad mouthing you. And O'Reilly. They can call black folk all kind of names all day long. What are you going to do? You can't respond. You can't even communicate with your own people because you don't have an economic base. 51% of all the prisons in the United States are black people. You only make up 12% of the population. That's no accident. It's because you don't control the economics and the politics. And they're going to go after the weakest people they can get their hands on to incarcerate them. That's the black folk. And what are you going to do in response to them when they over-incarcerate you? You're going to go out and have a march, a demonstration. We're going to march. March for what? Who cares? Marching, they never changed anything.
Oh,
watching the Golden State Warriors parade in Oakland, California, the ball that brought them victory in the NBA Finals was probably just an afterthought. But to Skip Harween, president...
Many a young athlete entertains hoop dreams. Few, if any, have tried as hard to make them come true as the kid our Steve Hartman has gone to see.
Every week, he set himself up for disappointment. Every week, 13-year-old Jamarian Stiles came to this community center in Boca Raton, Florida, hoping to play basketball with the other kids. And every week, he was rejected.
They'll start picking teams, and I would be the only one left out. And then they'll just tell me, just go home and stuff. You can break someone's heart like that.
The problem was obvious to everyone but Jamarian. He lost his hands and most of his arms as an infant due to a rare bacterial infection. But he insisted that was no reason to give up his hoop dreams.
What about soccer? Have you heard of that sport?
Yeah, hear it every day.
Why don't you play soccer? That just seems like the obvious thing.
You would think that I would be good at soccer. I'm really not. I'm horrible.
Which is why, on the first day of class here at Eagles Landing Middle School, Jamarian took his case to basketball coach Darian Williams.
Yeah.
Said he wanted to be on the team this year.
I said, all great, well, just make sure you try out.
But you say, okay, great, but what are you really thinking?
This man has no arms.
Yeah.
How is he going to play basketball? But man, he told me, Mr. Williams, I've never been on a team before. Even if I don't play, I just want to be on the team. And how could I say no to that?
And that's how the Eagles got their first armless basketball player. Jamarian, number two there, quickly earned a reputation as the hardest worker on the squad.
He was usually the first one in the gym, usually the last one to leave.
Still, he sat on the bench most of the season.
Try one more.
Until last month. Coach put him in the game with about 6 minutes left. And when he eventually got the ball on the far side of the court, everyone yelled, shoot it! So he did. And sank. A three-pointer. And if you didn't quite see that, don't worry. Because shortly after, he got the ball again. This time on the near side. For another three-pointer at the buzzer. Jamarian Stiles, the kid no one would pick, was now everyone's hero. Needless to say, today, Jamarian can play all he wants at the community center. He just made the volleyball team and has every intention of playing football next year. Really, the only thing he won't play is the victim.
If I could wave a magic wand right now and give you your arms back, would you want them?
I don't need them.
You don't need them?
No.
Who needs hands when you've got this kind of touch?
People in the room that really are serious about importing or think that they're serious about importing, and I'll kind of give you my diabolical plan, and because I always have a motive, as I'm sure you've probably figured out by now. But we do, every year for the last several years, we've been taking war room members and private clients to China. I never charge to do that, nor will I ever charge to do it, because I don't want that much responsibility, because it's a big trip. What we do that's cool, this business is really evolving. Our business is really evolving. And Ryan Rowland and I are partners in Digital Marketer and a number of other businesses. And Frank's a partner in a couple of businesses with us. This year, we decided to kind of change up the way we were doing things, because what we were doing with the three of us were moving in sort of a pod, and we would go over and manage one of our businesses, and then we'd go over and manage another one, and then we'd go over and manage another one, sort of in a group. And it was sort of driving us crazy, because we're running multiple multi-million dollar businesses. It's hard to do. So we kind of split up our attention last year. So Ryan runs Digital Marketer, basically. That's his thing. Roland runs our events and consulting business and funnel optimization business. And I run our survival business and physical products business. I advise in the survival business. I don't run it. I advise in it, and I run the physical product side of our business. So in all of our businesses in the past, we've been very fortunate to bring together groups of syndicates or war rooms or whatever of people that the most powerful people in those particular verticals. So I hope to do that with importers, only because I know it will be a more powerful group And we've got power in some collective bargaining, collective buying, freight, cargo forwarding, and things like that. We do multiple containers a month, and we also have air cargo contracts. And one of the gentlemen I spoke with outside is in the air cargo business that flew in from Europe to kind of hang out with us this week and talk business with us, and that's all that they do. So the more that we there's strength in numbers in importing, right? So the more that we can buy of a thing, the cheaper that we can get it. The more stuff we can, the more things that we can share on a container, the less risk we have to take. So in other words, we might buy six things, put them on one container, and we get to test five or six markets, versus if you're by yourself, it's not efficient to do that, right? Or we may be able to negotiate air cargo contracts that are less expensive than because everything works on volume, you know, everything works on volume. So who right now is already importing? Wow, quite a few of you guys. All right. How many of you been to China? Okay, so most of you guys are importing already. Cool. How many of you are already selling something in e-commerce, not importing, but selling enough you're thinking about importing? Okay, so most of you guys are real, which was the point of the $100, by the way. I just didn't want a bunch of snapperheads up here taking up a lot of our time. If you're a snapperhead, I'm sorry. No offense to snapperheads. I want to talk just a little bit for the people who aren't as seasoned about importing of some of the benefits and kind of some of the rules, and then I want to talk about the trip. We will be going on a pretty extensive trip. It's a lot more, it's almost as much about networking and masterminding together on that trip as the trip itself. Because if for those of you that are seasoned importers, we are going to go to Canton Fair to all three phases. You don't have to go to all three phases. Most seasoned importers are already past going to the fair. They don't go anymore, right? I still go because I get a lot of ideas at the fair and I meet with a number of people. Pardon? Oh, I thought somebody said. Canton Fair is, without doubt, I think the largest trade show in the world. It almost has to be. And it's crazy. You will have, your brain will just want, you'll want to, your head will want to explode after you've been there for a day. And anybody that, look, you got nods all over the place, right? It's like going, ooh, I can make money with this, and I can sell that, and I can put this with this, and I can do that. You know, I've been going over there for 16 years now. So I started going, we were talking outside with Boris, I started going over there when the Guangzhou airport was made out of concrete and painted blue and had no air conditioning, right? And now it's one of the most beautiful buildings in the world, right? So why should you import? Well, there's a lot of good reasons to import. If you're not even a physical product seller, like, I don't know, Russell, are you selling physical at all now? Yeah. Are you? Okay. I didn't know if you were, but if you weren't, Russell Brunson, ladies and gentlemen, the original pimp. No, the original Iowa pimp, right? There are pimps in Iowa. There's only one. Russell's the only one. But if you're not selling physical products right now and you're in the information space, you control media. So when you have a list, the first time you drop a mail to a physical product, you are going to freak out because it's going to sell so much more than the information product you tried to sell the other day. Has that been your experience? Yeah, that has been for us. I mean, we were talking about the tripwire, the physical tripwires being so much better. To the list, to the internal list, they're even better still, right? So if you control media, you probably should be selling physical products. If you're going to sell physical products, you probably should be importing if you have the means to do so. It's not nearly as complicated as people think it is. There's a lot of ways to reduce the risk, okay? And there are risks associated to importing. I bought in 10,000 fuzzy duck puppets one time. You don't drink at trade shows. There's one lesson. One of the big benefits of importing, even though China prices are rising because of labor costs, there are other places in Asia to import from. I import from South America, Asia, and India primarily. There are a lot of reasons to import other than price. Basically, the Chinese own manufacturing. They really do. Even if their prices come up more, they'll probably still keep a pretty good chokehold on it because there's just nowhere you can get stuff done as quickly or as in as much mass as you can there. There are other regions like Taiwan, for instance. We import mass volumes of things from Taiwan. If you want to make a whole lot of something, Taiwan is much more efficient than China, typically, and you can get a better price. If you want to import a little bit of something that's handmade, the Philippines, a lot of times, is better than China if you want a small quantity, right? If it's a hand good, like a soft good, something sewn or something crafted. India is great for metals. South America is good for things that are more tasteful, like furnishings and rattan and art and craftworks. There are different places you go, but we're going to China. So people ask me, like, how much money is it going to cost me to import? The truth is, I shouldn't tell you this because it's not good advice. The truth is, you probably could go to Canton Fair and spend $5,000 on something and get a market test, right? Now, if you're going to do that, you're probably going to want to buy something small that you could air freight in, or something that you can buy a pallet or two of that you can put on the back of one of our shared containers coming in, or share a container with a buddy. It doesn't have to be with my container, by the way. I don't care, right? You share it with another guy, sit around to dinner, split a load, whatever. That's the way it works. But if you can bring in I want to be in the rubber band business right now. Right? I want to spend about $7,000 bringing in, I don't know, 7 or 8 pallets of rubber bands. So I'll be Mr. Rubber Bands, right? I'm going to be the rubber band king of the world, right? With all these wholesale rubber bands. That's only going to cost me $5,000, $6,000, $7,000 to give that a good size market test. And if it works, I'll spend $20,000 on buying a container of rubber bands and I'm in, right? You can absolutely do that. Now, the downer to that is, when I do that, I'm usually going over and buying 5 or 6 or 7 lines. 2 or 3 of them work, 3 or 4 of them don't, right? So I'm willing to take that financial risk that you guys might not be willing to take. Here, the good news is about the financial risk in China, most of the time, you can liquidate a bad buy for cost and get out of it. It's not really that risky. You know, if you can go to your competitor, and if you decide, hey, this is not working for me, just go to your competitor and sell them your inventory at your cost or 10 under cost, your direct cost, and you'll get out. So the risk is not as finite as everybody thinks it is. Well, what if I buy a container of these widgets and get stuck with them? I'm in trouble. The worst experience I ever had in China, I bought a bunch of vacuum sealers. These were commercial vacuum sealers that are used by, like, meat processors. I bought weird stuff. And I bought them, and I was in a hurry when I bought them. I bought a whole container of them because the price was great. And I said, you guys do 110. And the guy's like, oh, 110. And I hold up the plug, and I say, you 110 plug, America. And the guy goes, oh, yeah, 110 plug, no problem. So I get them about 8 weeks later, and we plug the first one in, and it goes, poof, right? Because all the internal workings were 220, but they put a 110 plug on it. Lesson one, learn how to write a really good spec. So that's, you know, you want to write a good specification. But what happened was, those things were selling in America for about $1,000. I bought them for about $200. So I had a whole load of them for $200 a piece. I lost, right? What I ended up doing, I sold the load to a South American company who could go in and rewire them and sell them with a 220 plug in South America and still make money. So I got back, I think I sold them for $190 or $180 a piece. So I lost $1,000 on the load. It's no big deal. So there's ways out. You know, a lot of people eBay off their soft inventory. That's a great way to get rid of stuff. But anyway, so how much money do you need? $5,000 on the bare bones minimum. I'd say $20,000 probably is more reasonable. You know, if you have an existing business, you already have sales volume, you know what you're selling, then I'd say infinite. You know, it's as much as you want to spend. If you know you're going to forecast out. The shipping time, you can have most, that's one of the good things about China. China's fast to manufacture. Most things can be made in about 20 days, right? And then they're now the time on the water is down to less than 20 days. So you're talking about 40 days from the time you have a confirmed order, it can be setting at LA, right? So, and being ready to go through customs. Air freight, even better. Like all our credit card knives, every credit card knife we've sold so far, we've brought in by air. So I order them on Monday and I get them the next Monday. So it's not nearly the cost of money and the time lag is not that bad. People ask a lot of times about payment and how orders are made. From a cash flow perspective, again, not nearly as bad as everybody thinks it is. Typically speaking, when I place an order, I place it with a 30% down payment. I pay another 30% when it's at the Chinese dock ready to ship. So I'm only 20 days away from receiving it. And I pay the balance while the shipment is on the water for release of documents. They call it a TT. So basically, they won't release the documents at the LA port for me to get my goods until the shipper says that I paid. You understand? So I'm going to be out 2/3 of the money. I'm already at 60% of the money 20 days before I get the thing. So if I'm buying a $10,000 load of something, most things, oddly enough, has anybody found this, that a container of just about anything's 20 grand? It's so weird. It's just a weird number. But most things, it's about $20,000 a container. It's like, what's in it? Don't matter. It's 20 grand. So you're paying about 6 grand up front, about 6 grand when it's ready to ship, and you're paying about 8 grand when it releases, just a few days before it releases in LA. So that last payment, what I do online is when I make that last payment, I turn the product live. And I just put a longer lead time, like a 7-day ship time. So I start selling them the day that I make my final payment. So they're still in customs. They're still coming through. Now, that's risky. You get your ass pitched doing that. I never have. But I got a load held one time for 14 days, and it made me pucker up pretty good. But for the most part, it's not bad. So how can you buy? So for you guys who are totally inexperienced, I don't know, a lot of people start off, how many of you guys started buying something on Alibaba? Right? Quite a few, right? So Alibaba, TTNet, there are a number of websites that you can buy from. That's okay if you're buying a really small quantity of something. Know this, the price that you're quoted, typically, the way you approach the vendor makes a huge difference with these factories. If you send a guy a message on Alibaba and say, hey, how much for these? You're going to get the total asshole price, right? Because the way they see you, the way the market sees you, you're an inexperienced buyer. You're going to lose all your money. They might as well get as much of it out of you right now as they can because somebody's going to, right? So they're going to try to hit you as hard as they can. If you send them a fax, oddly enough, a fax on letterhead will get you a better price still. A longer conversation where you ask more questions will get you a better price still. But you're only going to get so far dealing with a very low-level person who's running the Alibaba desk for whatever factory, right? The second way, and there are all kinds of ways I can help you through the Alibaba process, but and we still do buy through Alibaba, but it's we try not to, right? When you go to the show, that's the next worst thing, right? So when you're walking through Canton Fair and you walk up and go, ooh, how much are those? And you're talking to the lady who works for the lady who works for the lady that works for the dude that runs the factory. She's got a price list that is retail fundamentally, and she says this much. And if you go, wow, that's cheap, you're screwed, right? So that's not the best strategy either, right? There are certain customs when you're working the show, like. For instance, you should always have a subordinate with you, or somebody should play the subordinate, right? And the subordinate should talk to the subordinate. The principals don't talk to the subordinates. The principals only talk to the principals. So there's certain customs that you follow to get the best possible price. You're going to get, so let's say an item for me on Alibaba is $10. And that's the best I can get out of it. If I start at $10, I can probably work them down maybe $8-$9 on Alibaba. If I go to Canton Fair, maybe I'm $6-$7, right? The real money's made when you go to the factory. So you go to the factory and you put them in, you basically turn around the table and you put them in an interviewing situation where they're interviewing to be your vendor, interviewing you to be their supplier on the product, right? And you ask for their certifications, you ask for their government documentation, you ask for their turnover and their documents and their books and all this stuff. And you know what that makes you look like? Makes you look like a buyer, right? And if you look like a buyer, they're going to treat you like a buyer. If you look like a dumbass, guess what they're going to treat you like, right? So they'll really treat you like a buyer. Even the way you go through the show, you need a notebook. You need a stapler, right? You need to put your business cards at the top of the pad. You need to write notes under every page when you're there. You need to staple it to the top. You need to carry a certain kind of, because you know why? Because that's the way they do it. And that's the way they see chain store buyers do it. And if you behave like a chain store buyer, they will treat you like a chain store buyer. If you behave like a wholesaler, they'll treat you like a wholesaler. And you'll get elevated up the channel. right? So this is all common stuff that you, most of you guys already know, but I want to go over it for the people who haven't been before. Vetting the vendor, that's the next thing. The biggest mistake people make is not vetting their vendors well. There are a couple of ways to do that. Kind of a bobo way is, but I'm leaning on it more and more now because GES is so damn expensive. I use this service called Import Genius that's fantastic. It keeps up with all of the bills of lading of everything that comes into the United States. So if you want to go like on Import Genius, it's about $300 a month. And if you don't need to use it much, you can get a hold of my staff with Emil or somebody if you're going to be traveling with us, and we'll look them up for you. I don't want you to have to buy another subscription. It's maybe more than $300, maybe $600 a month. It's a lot. Does anybody else use it? Import Genius? Yeah? It's awesome, right? Yeah, because what happens is you go in and enter, like I just did one a day or two ago for Things Remembered, the engraving store, because we're in the engraving business. In 10 seconds, it showed me every shipment they brought in the last year, what factory it came from, what was on it, how much of it they bought. So I know, not only do I know where they're buying everything they're buying, I know what they're buying, I know how much of it they're buying. And if they're buying it over and over and over again, because guess what that tells me? It's a control. It's working. They must be selling a lot of it. So I can basically tell you, I can take that data, and if I drill down enough, I can tell you what the makeup of Things Remembered's corporate sales is. What their number one selling product is in the store, what their number two selling product is in the store, what their number three selling product is in the store. And the other thing that it gives me is the ability to see which vendors they're buying from. Would you think they probably do a pretty good job at vetting a vendor? Yeah. Right? Yeah. So this guy's quick right here. They do a good job with quality control and vetting their vendors. So I don't have to pay GES $1,000 to go out. GES is a testing service. I don't have to pay GES $1,000 to go out and interview and inspect this factory and look at my loads coming out and all that, because they're probably a pretty reliable factory. Now, what you can do next in Import Genius that's really cool is you can change the center target to the vendor itself, and it'll show you everyone else in the United States that vendor's selling to. So it reverses the process. So if I find out that Things Remembered is buying from a vendor who's also selling to Saks Fifth Avenue and to Kohl's and to other major retailers, I know now that's really a qualified vendor, right? That's really a qualified vendor. So I don't have to worry about them too much. Are they going to be the cheapest vendor? Probably not, right? But it's negligible. It's not much difference when you get right down to it. Sometimes they are, though, oddly enough, and that's why they have all the business. Ordering. So once you decided you want to buy something from China, this is like the China talk in 10 minutes. Once you decided you want to buy something from China, you really need to place a formal offer. You need to do a formal request for quotation. They're going to give you one back, and then you place your order. Is the price that you put on the order the same price that you get back in the quotation? For me, it never is. I always send my order in at what I want to pay, not what they quote. And about 8 times out of 10, they will eventually accept my order, right? And that's just a simple way. I do two little tricks. I'll give you two little tricks for importing for those guys that do import. I ask for a quantity usually 5 to 10 times more than I'm actually going to buy. So I get that price to start with, so I get them to drop their pants all the way down. And now I work back up. I know they're going to bump me, but it's not going to be as bad as if I start with a low quantity and work the other way, right? So I'll call up a guy and go, hey, I want to buy some rubber bands. The guy says, wow, that's cool. How much you want? I think I want 100,000 pounds of rubber bands. What's your per pound price? Well, it's $2 a pound. Okay, that sounds pretty good. Well, here's an order for 10,000 pounds of rubber bands. Oh, well, you said 100,000 pounds. You know, our 10,000 pound price is, it's hard for him at that point to say, well, our 10,000 pound price is $5. So he's going to come back at $225, $250, and that's okay. I'll accept that and move on. But usually whatever he comes back at, let's say he comes back at $250, I'll probably split the difference and send him a PO at 2.25. And he'll bitch and moan about it a little bit, but then he'll fulfill on it most times. Not always. Sometimes he'll just say no. But it's always worth a try. That little thing saves me about $20,000 to $30,000 a month. Just that one little tactic, right? Payments, I've already talked about a third, a third, and a third. I send TT payments to Chinese factories all the time. I have yet, I think this is wood, to ever just be totally ripped off. It's the weirdest thing, because you wouldn't do it with a U.S. factory hardly. But I'll send these guys $10,000 on a first order in the hopes that eventually they'll send me something. And I, to date, I've never been ripped off. They have a, over there, it's very difficult to get an exporter's license. Only about 5% of all the factories have the ability to export. A lot of the other factories that make stuff broker it to factories who have an export license. So the guys that have an export license that are that can do export for you, they're probably not going to screw you. Because if they get a complaint or two, or somebody, and sometimes, guess what happens when you get complaints in China? You just don't, you're not there anymore. You go away. I'm not kidding. I'm not kidding. Like, where are the generals at? I did a dinner one time. We used to have these generals that worked with this one factory we sold to. And every time we'd go over, there were two generals that would come to the dinner. And they were generals in the Chinese Army. And they were evidently stockholders in the factory. And they would come to all the dinners, and we'd do entertainment and go out and party with them and all that. And I went over one time, and we're having a dinner, and the two generals aren't there. And I said, where are the two generals at? I said, they're gone. And I said, where'd they go? They're gone. And I said, well, what are they doing now? And my guy's like, don't talk about that anymore. They're gone. Like Sopranos kind of gone. Yeah, yeah.
For example, like if we go over to China, can you actually put a purchase in or an offer in while you're there?
Yeah, you know what's changing, by the way? Yeah, it's a good point. I'm glad you brought that up, because the last two times I've been, it freaked me out a little bit. Something you're going to want with you is cash. Has anybody noticed that? Who goes to Canton lately? Who's been asked for cash on the floor? Have you been? It's weird. The last show I went to, they're wanting cash now. They're wanting a cash deposit, $500, $1,000, something when you place an order. And I think the reason why, I think so many people just going, oh yeah, I want this, and they'll order. They spend a lot of time with them, and then they're going to follow up when they get back, and they never do. So the factories now are wanting. I bought from one cat factory $96,000 worth of stuff, and she says, can you make a deposit? I'm like. And I'm thinking, shit, that's going to be like a lot. How much? And she says, maybe $500. and we're a bunch of guys on credit cards, so we scrape up $500 and we give to her. It's peculiar, but they just really don't want to spend the time getting all the stuff together. Now, what was weird about that was really weird, and I don't think they would normally do it. What was really weird about that is I gave her the $500. I came back, and we were about 2 weeks before we ever got the order formalized and in. When we sent them the order, the machine was almost done. So they had been building the machines based on the $500 deposit, which really surprised me. You know, I would have never thought they would have done that in a million years. With the way they're working over there, the way their system works, they have infinite financing basically for factories. So, be right with you. They have infinite financing for factories. So when you send them an order, they can go get money to buy the raw materials to make that order right away. So just based on your PO. So they're able to borrow some money, and they take your one-third that you pay down, and they borrow the rest. So the way the way I understand it works, and I don't know for sure, but this is the way I understand it works. If they're spending 60% on materials to build the order, you pay a third, they're going to go to the bank and borrow the other third, right? When the thing gets to the dock, and you release the other third, they're going to take that money and they're going to pay their loan off, right? And then when they get the final third, that's profit. So that's kind of how they operate. But they also get something called VATs and rebates from the government, which is a whole different ball of wax I don't have time to go into. So they're into selling lots of volume, because the government at the end of the year writes them a check for a percentage of their total gross sales. It's called a VAT. It's a return of tax. Because they're like, we have tax-exempt status. When we buy stuff to make products in the United States, we don't pay sales tax. They do. So they're buying, when they're buying steel, they're paying sales tax. When they're buying stone, they're paying sales tax. But at the end of the year, if they can show that that product went out of the country, the government rebates them all that sales tax. And a lot of the factories will run completely on that rebate. So especially in plastics or rubbers or high volume businesses. Yeah. There are two things, and that's a good question. We have people on the ground in China, which is another reason that I want to have more people in our group, right? I have one person in China right now, Mr. Go, who goes to factories for me. Mr. Go, his name is actually Mr. Go, but he goes to factories. I've got a picture. I wish I had it. I've got a screen. I've got a picture of Mr. Go on a rowboat with a generator. So after that thing happened with the sealers. That the factory that made those sealers was on an island outside, I forget which port, near Shanghai, actually. They were on an island. So we were trying to figure out how we're going to make this work because they don't have 220, they don't have 110 in China. But they have generator factories that make factories for America. So we bought a generator, and I have a picture of Mr. Go, my guy, with a generator on a rowboat with a guy rowing him across the water to go to this island, and he would literally go in, set down the generator, crank it up, running on diesel, right, and plug in my machines and shoot videos of my machines running. So having somebody on the ground, especially with a new vendor that you don't know, is incredibly important. If you don't have a staff member to do that, I have a staff guy, huh?
Do you have those contacts to introduce?
Well, I do, and I would be willing to share like my guys, and that would help me reduce some of my costs, because actually I would like to have two or three other people in China. But I don't want to spend that money out of my pocket completely. I'd share it because I'd like to have people that go source to the factories, because what I could do is I can send them over to negotiate for me in person and give me a way better price than I can get over the phone. And like Kevin, I had dinner with Kevin Harrington last night, and he doesn't go over anymore. So they got their own staff people to go negotiate. It presents a whole other set of problems because then they'll make side deals. So there's all kinds of shit that goes on with this. But experience will help you past most of that. But there's a company called GES Services that will charge you between $600 and $800 a load, typically. They've got offices all over China. They'll go to the factory when the load is ready to load up, right? Or they'll even go different times during the process, just more expensive. And they'll go in and test the product, video the product, take pictures of the product, real detailed, send them back to you and say, is this all right? You know, they'll video it doing things. They'll, make sure it's functioning the proper way. That $1,000 is the cheapest money, by the way, you'll ever spend. Yeah. Yes, sir.
I already have a Mr. Go, but
yeah.
I still run into the problem of not getting what I've ordered. Do you know any insurance companies that will insure your shipments for your manufacturing?
You know what? I've not used them. Those guys set up at Canton Fair, there are guys that do it. But I don't know. GES will basically insure it for sure. That's kind of what you're paying GES for, because you can go back on GES. If GES says it was the right way and it's not when it gets here, you can go back on GES, sort of like a home inspector. You know what I mean? Be a pain in the ass. But GES, if you're dealing with ISO companies most of the time and you're dealing with GES, they're not going to screw with GES because they don't want to get a bad reputation with the GES guy, because the GES guy's in their factory every couple of days for another vendor. So,
I do more sports equipment.
Yeah, so you got kind of shit factories, yeah.
And sometimes Mr. Go, you don't know the difference between, the stitches are going to rip out on, say, a boxing glove.
Yeah.
Like that. He looked at it, oh, Mr. Scott, everything looks great.
Yeah. If you can design testing, like if you can design stress testing and things, GES will execute, they'll execute your test. But no, seriously, you could have, if you want to take them and take the thing and hit it with a sledgehammer 10 times to see if it falls apart, they'll do that. You know, but you just have to design the test to send them and tell them what the result should or should not be. Yeah. Other than that, it really comes down to developing good vendor relations. And when you get a good vendor, treat them really good. Don't beat them to death and keep trying to hammer them down because because you saved a penny. Yeah. They want to know about, I go over with a whole sheet on us. I've got a whole packet of who we are, what we do, our volume numbers, our because you know why? Because that's the way they do it.
Right.
So when you get a catalog from most Chinese factories, the first three or four pages are all their certificates and awards they've won, a picture of their president, a picture of the president of the company with the president of China going like that because they think you care, and on all those things. So like I buy a bunch of stuff from a guy right now that makes javelins and track and field equipment. And he makes all the track and field equipment for the Chinese Olympic teams. And he's super proud of that. It's all over his catalogs. So the more stuff, if you create a package, and I also create my own credit package when I go over in advance, because that's what the big guys do. So I go over with, here's my bank reference. I'm with Wells Fargo. Here's my banker. Here's my balance sheet. Here's all my stuff. So that when I tell them that I'm, because a third is not a given, right? Some people, if they're new, they might ask for 50% or 70%. I get a third, and I don't ever try to beat them up much past that. I've got some factories now that I order, and I don't pay anything till it gets to the dock. But I've been dealing with them for a while. My buddy Dave's got factories that he orders. I've got one factory that I order from, Water Filter Factory. I don't pay for the merchandise until it's been in the United States 60 days. But that took a long time to establish. Now, there's also a new bank. There's a new government. Well, it used to be an insurer, a Chinese insurer. They're now giving out loans. They're now setting up loans for importers because the Chinese economy and importing is going down. So the Chinese government's got what? What do they have a lot of?
Cash.
So they're taking their cash and loaning it to people who want to import stuff from China on short-term loans. So it's real easy if you've got decent credit. Like if you got a 700 Beacon and maybe own a home, they'll give you a $200,000-$300,000 line at almost no interest. Yeah.
Do they factor off orders?
You don't have to. They won't really factor off orders, but they'll just give you a certain line based on your personal credibility. Yeah. And pardon? I'll get you the name. I don't recall. Not that I'm trying to keep it from you. I just don't remember. We got set up through a war room member. One of our war room members, Dong Mai, she's very connected to the Chinese government. So she got us set up with that. And we filled out like a piece of paper, and they gave us like $1 million. It was crazy. Yeah. It took like a day. I don't know how in the hell, and I don't have any, and guess what? There's no personal guarantee on it. It's a corporate thing. So now will that happen to you? I don't know. But we have a lot of money in the bank. We have a good relationship with Wells Fargo and other things. So we were pretty credible. But it was like, how could they even have checked us out so quickly? They gave us, Alibaba is getting in the business now of providing financing for importing. So that's their new thing too. Yeah.
I need a mold made of an object that I want to create.
Yep.
So do I draft it here?
I don't know about the drafting part. It depends on what it is. The mold making by far is cheaper there. I mean, probably 20 cents on the dollar what it is in the U.S. Now, the challenge sometimes is the tooling. I try to own the mold, right? And the challenge is, depending on who the factory is, they may be using that mold in a Chinese machine, and that tooling's not going to fit any other machine. So you kind of, is it plastic?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. You probably want to check. I forget, there are standard injection molding machines that are internationally recognized. I would try to work with factories that have those molding machines, because then you own the mold, and if you ever want to switch factories, they're bound to give you the mold back, but what are you going to do if they don't, right? So that's the only downer. It's almost, you got to pay the cost, it's less, but then the mold is practically disposable, versus if you get the mold made in the States, they're legitimate, they will give you the mold. But by far it's better. Now, that business is touchy, because if it's wrong, man, it's just damn wrong, you know? Yeah.
Where can we find out more information about doing the importing line of credit, stuff like that?
I'll have to get, is Emil in here? Yeah, Emil can get, he'll get everybody's contact information if you'll give all that to Emil. He's going with us to China, by the way. If you want him to get you that, we'll send out a pack with all that in it. Okay. I'm almost done with this part. Freight and duty, collective bargaining gets you better freight rates. A container right now to LA is anywhere between $2,600 and $4,000, depending on whether it's a low a lower, what's called a high, high cube. Yeah, high cube. If you're packing a lot of really light goods, you can go into high cube. It's fluffy. If it's dense, you want to go into 20 or 40. Yeah.
Can you refer us which manufacturers do have the export license? I mean, do you know?
Yeah, anybody that's at the show, by the way, will have an export license, and they can't. They literally cannot put anything out the door without one. So anybody you're going to come into contact with pretty much does have. If you find a factory that doesn't, I've done that before, you can get some amazing prices, but it's really risky. And usually those factories are difficult to communicate with, and you're going to have to pay somebody, or they're going to have to pay somebody a VIG to get the goods through. So now they may have a brother-in-law that owns another factory somewhere, and they can shove it on through his factory, and he won't charge them, or he'll charge them 5% or something. But it's becoming more and more difficult. And I'll tell you, if you want adventure, now that's China real. What we're doing is China light. This factory, we went to a factory in China a couple of years ago outside Shanghai, about a three-hour drive outside Shanghai, and we got there just as dusk was coming in, and a buddy of mine was in a minivan. They took us all in a van, and he wasn't feeling well when we got there. It was the bumpy roads and stuff. And we didn't see a car for the last hour. We saw motorbikes and oxen. That was it. And we got there, and this company, by the way, was making pharmaceutical equipment. Machines, by the way, that fill IV bottles out of stainless steel. The room that they were working in was the size of this room, about right there. They had five or six machines under construction, and in the center of the room, and I swear to God I'm not lying, there was one naked 100-watt light bulb, and it was dusk. And they'll work till 10 o'clock at night that way, right? There's over to the left-hand side was a barracks with a bunch of concrete beds, no mattresses in them, right? They work 12 hours in the factory. They go over and sleep on the concrete, right? Now, I bought equipment from them. It was good equipment. When I had service issues, I was in big trouble because I couldn't communicate with the people. It was difficult. They were, and they had given me all the skin off of it too. There was no profit. There wasn't hardly any profit left in what they were doing, so they didn't have a lot of room to service. See, you want to really kind of you don't really want to do that. If you're buying kettlebells, maybe, because only so much shit breaks on a kettlebell, right?
And then as far as finding somebody to sell the wholesale, sell what you purchased in China, is it hard to find a retailer over here for the product?
Yeah, it's almost impossible, in fact, unless you have a reason for them to buy it, because there's no longer a value in being an importer. Mm-hmm. Like, there used to be a whole industry that was Kmart would go to me because I was an importer, and they would buy stuff that I bought for a quarter for 50 cents, and they'd sell it for a dollar. And then eventually, as China has gotten safer and more easy to maneuver and things like that, they just have buyers there now. So there's no reason for them to buy from you. So the reason they'll buy from you is if you have a proven selling product under your brand, right? If you have a proven selling product, it's not your brand, and you go show it to them, you're the biggest dummy on earth. Right? Because like right now, I talked to Harrington last night about, I've got this product called the Selfie Stick, which is really cool. It's a, hopefully you will see it on television very soon. But it's a stick, it's a telescoping stick that you put a iPhone on, and down here at the bottom there's a remote control button, so you sit here and take pictures. They have those already, right? They're already selling them. I think that we'll sell the Selfie Stick and build a brand out of it. And then the Selfie Stick will go into Bed Bath & Beyond. Where if I go to Bed Bath & Beyond and say, ooh, I got this awesome thing. It's a stick. You put a phone on it. You can take a picture. It's cool. They're going to go, wow, that is cool. You mind if I take a picture of that? Done. Right? You add no value then. They want to know that the first question you're going to be asked when you go to a retailer, where's your media? That's the first question you're going to be asked. Where's your media? What are you going to do? I've been asked this question a lot of times, so be prepared for it if that's your plan. What are you going to do to bring a customer into my store to buy your thing? I am not in the business of building you a business. That's what the retailer will tell you. All right? Now, if you have the number one selling camera pod on Amazon and Newegg and Sears.com, then yeah, are they going to put you in? You betcha. And everybody, oh yeah, that's a selfie stick. Have you seen one of those? They're really cool, right? That's a whole different animal. So either you can license a brand or you can, you know, there's got to be a reason why. You've got to either have proof of a winner that you control some IP on, right? And maybe it's just your design. And that's the cool thing about China. Try not to go to China and buy what's sitting on the table. Yeah. Have them change a handle. Have them do something. Yes, ma'am.
Yes, when you are negotiating your per unit price to figure out your ROI and you're trying to figure out shipping, do you share the shippers out of China through the manufacturer?
No.
Or do you use your own?
Yeah, use your own. Use your own forward. You use a U.S. forwarding company who will also have an office in China. So they but the better, almost all the forwarding companies that are in the States that are of size, they have offices at all the port cities in China. So they communicate from here to there, and that's what they get paid for.
Well, that's interesting because that's the struggle I've had in pricing the product to figure out my ROI because I can't get
it. Just always price at FOB their port, so their closest port. Oh. Don't quote at FOB a U.S. port. Yeah.
Thank you.
Another thought, because I was actually looking at purchasing lead magnets, what have you. Do you have relationships, or does your Go guy have relationships with manufacturers for an innovative product? I have a guy that designed something that needs to be built and manufactured with.
Build all your prototyping in the States. I mean, you need to go over when you go to China to buy. If you draw a picture of a football. And you spec the football in a blueprint, you'll get back a basketball. You need to take the football.
Right. Well, my question is this: it's kind of I have friends in India.
Yeah.
I'm going to go to India because I have friends on the ground there that I've known, what have you. Because the rule of thumb is that if you take an innovative product to China, they're going to steal it.
Thing, right? So they got another town that makes watches and another town that makes neckties and another town that does whatever. So it's pretty cool, man, that it's to the way we would think as Americans, it seems really weird, but I can see the engineering of their system is actually pretty smart in certain ways. Like I was in one town, the whole damn town, it's a big ass town. They make neckties. Think about for a minute how many ceramic tiles there are in the world. Because you'll be shocked when you go to Canton Fair, you're in America, you don't mean shit. You're 6%. You're 6% of the audience. That's it. The other 94% are from Africa, Russia, Australia, everywhere else in the world. They're supplying the world. They're not, and they don't care nearly as much about us as they used to. Although we're a big consumer. We're just another customer right now. Yeah. So, yeah.
Is there some place with, well, you're concerned with chemicals as far as the plastics and consumables and things that kids are going to be playing with? Is there some kind of agency over there that can
GES.
Watchdog?
GES. GES owns that whole market of, they'll test chemicals, they'll test toxins, they'll do all kinds of stuff. But you got to give them the tests you want.
Right.
And then they'll carry them out. Yeah. Well, guys, thank you so much. Emil Prilik is in the back with Shirley Tan. If you guys will please give, if you really think you want to go, like Fresh Key or Word Tracker or Keyword Search, and see what people in your market are looking for. Like, if you're thinking about bringing in handbags or whatever, you know, look up handbag in the Keyword Search. You might find that monogram handbags are hot or brown leather handbags are hot or denim handbags are hot. That way you know what's moving, you know, I don't know what your line is, but you seem very fashionable, so I'm sorry to pick on you if you don't do something that's fashionable. But it's much safer. By all means, it's much safer to do that. Sometimes I do that. Oftentimes I don't. Oftentimes I just see something and say, damn, that looks cool. I think I can sell that. And I'll buy a bunch of them. And I'll take the risk because I know probably if I buy them and it sucks, I won't buy this thing for $10. I'm going to try to sell it for $50, right? If it sucks and it doesn't sell, I can probably liquidate it to somebody for $10. Now, there's a couple of other ways. I will give you one big tip on a way you can do this. I got in the hand dryer business this way. I own Handy Dry, so we make these hand dryers, like bathroom hand dryers. The way that I got in that business was I found those hand dryers for $50 in China. They sell in the States wholesale for about $225, right? They retail $495, right? Great item, right? So I didn't know if I could sell them or not. So I found a guy in my same office complex. I got lucky where I was before, and he owned a Swisher franchise, which they do all the bathroom sanitation and cleaning. So I went over to him and I said, "Man, you sell these things?" I said, "Yeah." He said, "Yeah, we sell quite a few of them." I said, "Man, what are you paying?" He said, "Man, they're like $2.25." I said, "Dude, I found them in China for $100 a piece. You want to split a load with me?" And that's how I got in the hand dryer.
He was my hero growing up because what my dad did is he was importing back in the day when importing was something very new. Australians really didn't know how to get products from overseas. And the way he went about it is he made contacts in Hong Kong. If you want to go back to China back in when it was super communist, you really need to go through Hong Kong. So he was bringing in items all through my childhood. And the cool thing was that often he would see the things that I liked and the things that I was attracted to as a kid or my mum or my two elder brothers were interested in. And he would use that as a way of gauging and asking friends and family and bringing them in. And has anyone ever heard of Donkey Kong? Put your hands up in the air if you have. Okay, great. Has anyone ever, like back in the 80s, and I'm talking, you know, 85, 86, ever play with those little handheld Donkey Kong games? Show of hands. Okay. Do you know my dad brought them in? That was my dad, and it was awesome because all the kids at school thought I was really cool because I had Donkey Kong, and they also thought that Benny Elias, the football player, was my uncle. So, you know, only one of them was true. So that's Donkey Kong. And my dad brought them in. He just brought in absolutely everything. We had remote control cars. It was every day was Christmas, you know, when you grow up with a dad who's an importer. So, you know, I grew up with the eye for products. I knew what people liked and didn't like. And it was just, it's basically, I kind of inherited it in a way. It's kind of in the blood. So I kind of strayed for a little bit and made the supreme mistake of doing a law degree. At the University of New South Wales, I'm not saying that was a mistake. That was a fantastic institution. I learned a lot. But see, the thing is that I always wanted to be a barrister. You can probably see I'm enjoying all the attention right now from all you people here, and I wanted to do so in front of a judge and an adversary and get up there and really argue a point in court. And unfortunately, something happened about 2 years in is I saw my big brother, Jason, and he worked for Baker McKenzie, which is one of the biggest law firms ever. And I could just see, and he just wasn't looking happy. And here he was after long interview processes at the best firm, and he was following the yellow brick road all the way to partnership, and I could just see he's unhappy. And the reason was is that he was just trading his time, for dollars. And it didn't matter, you know, whether you're working McDonald's or you're working in a big law firm, at the end of the day, if you're trading time for dollars, you know, there's only a limit to what you can earn. And he is now a successful businessman. He actually, you combine the two, he's now recruiting lawyers, and he has a legal recruitment firm that does very well, and I'm very proud of him for that. But what he gave me was the advantage to shoot 10 years in the future, because he's 10 years older than me. And however hard he worked, I just don't work as hard as him. So I knew that even if I got into that big law firm, even if I had those opportunities, which I probably wouldn't, because let's face it, I'm significantly lazier than my brother, then that was going to be a problem. So I made a decision, and that was that I was going to start looking around for something else, you know, while I was studying my degree. But while with the safety, and I did finish it in the end of the day, and my mum's very proud of me for completing my law degree. So I went on eBay one day, and I was just shopping. And the first thing, does everyone remember the first thing they brought on eBay? Anyone remember the first thing you ever bought? Anyone has bought something interesting as their first item on eBay? Don't be shy. Yes, sir? You're nodding your head with a big smile. Do you remember the first thing you bought on eBay?
Electric guitar.
Electric guitar. Fantastic. Mine was a Monkey Magic DVD. You guys are laughing if you remember Monkey. Hands up, whoever has seen the show Monkey Magic. I loved this show as a kid, and when I realized you could actually go on an internet and buy it from someone, it was like, wow. So I bought the Monkey Magic DVD, and I was like, I couldn't believe that I actually paid someone for something on the internet and it arrived. Yeah. I was like, it actually came. When I forgot about it after order, and then I opened the door, there's a parcel for me. I'm like, what's this? And I was like, Monkey Magic, this is amazing. So then I fell in love with eBay, and I started thinking, hang on, maybe there's some money here. This guy just made $30 off me. Maybe I can make some money. So What I did is I bought some people's stuff that I found the ads were really bad. They're really badly designed, terrible photos, really bad description. They put the auction for 1 or 2 days without letting an audience really build up and get excited and bid it up. And I'd buy products, and then I would use just clever techniques to make it better. Better pictures with a better digital camera, multiple angles, better listing and description. I would go online and do a research of it and put a review of the product. All these different things, you know, good word, good copywriting, that type of thing. And I found that I was actually able to take someone else's product and make 20, 30, 40% profit by just selling their product and making it look more attractive. And that was like, suddenly I thought, wow, this is absolutely amazing. And the first thing I properly ended up buying to make money was DVD players. Has anyone heard of a company called Deals Direct? Show of hands, who've heard of this company. Leave your hands up and leave them up now if you've actually ever bought anything from Deals Direct. So we've got about quite a few people in the room. That's very interesting. They, in fact, were the people that started me off in eBay in a way. They were a company called Auction Brokers, and they were the biggest seller. And I was like, these guys are amazing. I want to be as big as them. And I bought 100 DVD players from them that were retail returns from Harvey Norman. And they weren't working. If customers didn't like them for whatever reason, they gave them back. And I knew that they were sold as is. So I bought the 100 for about $3,000, so it was 30 bucks a piece. I went in with one of my best friends, and I tested 60 of them, and they worked. You know, it was painstaking. You had to plug it in, put a DVD in, you know, and that was it. But 40 of them didn't. And out of the 40, I was able to cannibalize parts and, you know, make another 20 work, and then I had 80. So I sold those 80, made a good profit on those, and the 20 I sold to scrap metal to someone in Melbourne, and that was pretty awesome. So eventually, I was looking for more products to sell on eBay, and I was kind of buying them from Australians and other people. I was kind of buying, anyone here now buying wholesale or buying from Australian suppliers and are looking to go to China? Is anyone in that category? Okay, fantastic. So I became what's called an eBay power seller, which are the most respected and the people who can push quantities on eBay. It means you have to keep a rating, a feedback rating over 98%, right? And it also means that you're pushing large quantities. And at my peak, my eBay feedback was over 10,000. That means 10,000 separate people. And that was great, because I remember when I had 10, 20, and I was like, I'll never get to 100. I'll never get to 1,000. Then I got to 10,000. So I was making quite a bit of money. But the problem was, and I was limited, because I had to wait till auction brokers put new products on. And I had to wait till other people had products I could buy in Australia. I didn't really see how I could grow this business exponentially. So I was talking about the problem with my dad. And he said to me, son, you're being stupid. Go to China. Just like that, go to China. So what did I do? I went to China. Fantastic. And there's a map of China there. And hands up who's actually been. Who's visited China before? Okay, that's great. It's quite a big representation. That's amazing. And these are the cities I went to. I actually did part of my law degree. I studied contract law in Beijing at the University of Political Science there. And that was a very interesting experience. But these are the other cities I went to. Guangzhou, which for some reason we call Canton. I've never quite figured that out. Something from imperialist England. And, of course, Hong Kong, which is your gateway into China. Dongguan City, Nanjing, Shanghai, Shenzhen, which is the first city you get to when you get off the train station at Luwu after Hong Kong. That's just a complete mind freak when you go to that country, when you go to Shenzhen, because you've just come from Hong Kong, which is all populated, and then bang, you're in Shenzhen. Suzhou, which is amazing. It's like Venice. It's like Venice, but in China. It's like the Venice of the East. That you've got to see that city. And Xi'an. Does anyone know what Xi'an's famous for?
Terracotta Warriors.
Bingo, the Terracotta Warriors. And that was the holiday. I wasn't there for work. I've been to Yiwu, and this is actually probably one of the best secrets that I'm going to give away tonight. This little city called Yiwu, it's also pronounced EU, like the United, like European Union, EU. But that's how it's spelled. The cool thing about this place, and if you go to China, I do encourage you to check this place out. It's cooler than Guangzhou, in my opinion. Everyone knows about Guangzhou. In April, there's going to be a trade fair. There's going to be lots of things going on in Guangzhou, but you've got to order things from factories and wait. But you can buy, there are wholesale markets in EU. And these wholesale markets, you can actually buy products that are ready-made and ship them straight to Australia. You can consolidate 3 or 4 or 5 of them into a container and ship them to Australia without having to wait for time. And you only pay maybe 10 or 20% more than the factories. And that's great. So I really recommend that you go there. Okay, so I was importing over 100 products. I had, first thing I brought in were DVD players. Remember, I was buying them from auction brokers. So what did I need to do? Bring in my own brand. Why? Because I want to cut out the middleman wherever I can. Why? Because I want to make more profit. Why? Because I like buying goods and services. Why? Because they make me happy.
Like Fresh Key or Word Tracker or keyword search, and see what people in your market are looking for. Like if you're thinking about bringing in handbags or whatever, you know, look up handbag in the keyword search. You might find that monogram handbags are hot, or brown leather handbags are hot, or denim handbags are hot. That way you know what's moving. You know, I don't know what your line is, but you seem very fashionable. So I'm sorry to pick on you if you don't do something that's fashionable. Yeah, it's much safer. By all means, it's much safer to do that. Sometimes I do that. Oftentimes I don't. Oftentimes I just see something that says, damn, that looks cool. I think I can sell that. And I'll buy a bunch of them. And I'll take the risk because I know probably if I buy them and it sucks, I won't buy this thing for $10. I'm going to try to sell it for $50, right? If it sucks and it doesn't sell, I can probably liquidate it to somebody for $10. Now, there's a couple of other ways. I will give you one big tip on a way you can do this. I got in the hand dryer business this way. I own Handy Dry, so we make these hand dryers, like bathroom hand dryers. You know, and the way that I got in that business was I found those hand dryers for $50 in China. They sell in the States wholesale for about $225, right? They retail $495, right? Great item, right? So I didn't know if I could sell them or not. So I found a guy in my same office complex. I got lucky where I was before, and he owned a Swisher franchise, which they do all the bathroom sanitation and cleaning. So I went over to him and I said, man, you sell these things? I said, yeah. He said, yeah, we sell quite a few of them. I said, man, what are you paying? He said, man, they're like 2.25. I said, dude, I found them in China for $100 a piece. You want to split a load with me? And that's how I got in the hand dryer business. Right? But he's had, dude, we're going to have to come up with a deposit. Right? So he financed the whole thing. And when I got them, I got half a container. My half container was free. Right? So there's, and then, I could take a lot of risk then. You know, it's because most people, I'll tell you, I don't know how many people in this room, about 60 or 70, 4 or 5 of y'all are actually going to go to China, maybe. Most of you won't go. I mean, I've invited hundreds and hundreds of people. Most people chicken out the last minute. They freak out. I don't know what it is. They're just scared to death of going. And that's good. Because, you know, eventually you'll buy stuff from one of the other guys that go. And we'll make money. That, it's just, some people just aren't going to go. Some people, it's just not, they're just not ready yet either. There's nothing wrong with their decision. It's just not proper for them at the time. But it's a relatively low-risk business. Visas, by the way. You do have to apply for a Chinese visa. Chinese embassy's weird. You got to go ahead and buy your tickets and book your...
Okay, so we've listened to... And thank you, Pianchi, for sending me those links yesterday. I played, I think, all 5 of them. You can go to YouTube. Today's podcast is titled Visit China, Ship from China. And those, for people that want to, you know what, I'm going to post those on our Facebook group later today. I'll post all 5 of those videos from YouTube. For those people that are interested in import-export from China, from China, or Southeast Asia, he did mention in one of those parts, briefly mentioned Hong Kong and Vietnam and if you go through the videos on YouTube, as the labor prices in Hong Kong China are rising, you have some companies that are moving out of China and going into India or Vietnam, Laos, another part of Southeast Asia. So in any event, and then, of course, you also have quite a bit of Chinese companies that have operations in Africa, where the price of labor is even more sustainable. Anyway, let's go to our phone lines here. 314, your mic is open.
Hey, L.A., how you doing, man?
Fine, fine. Thank you. I played, I think I got all five of them.
Yeah, that's some pretty good information, ain't it?
Well, yeah, excellent, excellent.
And people have been doing that. You don't see no black folks doing it, though. You know, I know of one custom broker agent who's black, who have qualifications across the country to bring to import and export goods in out of the United States, and he also have an office set up in China.
Uh huh.
So. To get involved in that business, you have to have a custom broker agent. Now, Chinese have them.
Right.
When you go into the custom broker agent schools here in the United States, and that license is hard to get. It takes a lot of study and knowledge. You don't see anything but Asians in those classrooms. Of course, you don't see no blacks. But Asians make the stuff. Asians put it on their ships that they make. Asians bring it into the ports. And it's stored in their warehouses and cleared by Asian American custom broker agents.
Well, let me ask you this. Like, if you go to a place like Home Depot, Menards, or Lowe's, I know many of the items on the shelf there, even plumbing supply houses, a lot of that comes from China or somewhere in Southeast Asia. Now, would that include, like, lumber, pressure-treated wood, things of that nature?
Well, now, that's a good question. I don't know how much or if any, and if it did come here, it's going to be tariffs, right, heavy, because, you know, the United States have a lumber industry itself. And by
right.
the way, Canadian firms own, like, maybe 4 or 5 out of the top 10, which I think is ridiculous, but Trump is changing that. But a lot of the products that you made mention of, you know, you had the big scandal about drywall here some years ago that was being made in China.
Uh-huh.
But I can't tell you about the lumber.
Okay.
I doubt it, but I can't tell you about it. And if it is, I think it's tremendously it's wrong. See, China is made these leaps like it has by selling and making stuff that the United States can consume more so than
right.
any place else. And you got administration now that's saying that stuff's going to come to an end because what's happening, they use it to fuel their expansion in other areas where claim world dominance.
Yeah.
And I don't want to see that. I want to see the United States dominant. Because we have vested interests in the United States. We receive residual income from the United States institutions that can only exist in the United States that we've paid into and invested in. So, no, that you have to protect that. I'm sorry. It is the way it is.
What? What about this angle in the United States? I'm going to pick one company in particular. Well, a couple of examples. One high-profile example would be Airbnb. Now, Airbnb originally started in San Francisco, but now in that same city, then throwing New York City, New Orleans, Louisiana, and the largest cities in the United States, it's, in some places, it's severely regulated, or like in Fairfax, Virginia, I believe they're banned. And then on the smaller level, you've got like people that want to rent out a bedroom in their house to spare money. In many places in the United States, no problem. Don't even need a license. But in other places in the United States, usually with a larger population, they're regulated. If you get caught renting out a room, I mean, because what I'm seeing is, and it's different from place to place in this country, the how much the government can get into your pockets. And
well,
with
bed and breakfasts are usually controlled locally. They're not controlled by the federal government.
No, no, but and you're right there. And at one time, bed and breakfasts weren't even regulated. They're regulated now. But it all depends on what city you're in, though.
Well, like I said before, they are controlled locally.
Yeah.
Either
yeah.
locals or state, just like they do hotels. And they tax
right.
hotels, too. You know, when you look at your hotel bill.
That's more what, federally regulated?
What'd you, which one?
Import-export.
Yeah, that's,
you know,
that's
like
regulated
you
gotta, by that's regulated by U.S. Commerce.
Okay, U.S. Commerce, okay.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
Custom and Border Protection. They're
right.
one of the only agencies in the federal government that is self-dependent, that pays for itself.
All right.
When you bring goods into the
country,
like if you bring a T-shirt or a piece of apparel, it has to meet certain specifications. It has to have labels on how to care for that article, wash it, where it come from and what it's made out of. That has to be in
right.
that your shirt label in the back of your neck. Then they are inspected. When those containers come into the ports and when they leave out of there, well, let's put it like this. When they go into the port to be loaded, offloaded so they can get put on a ship, they go through equipment that has the ability to peer inside a container and check
right.
the radioactivity to make sure there's no, you know, radioactive bomb material, or make sure people ain't hiding in there.
Yeah, that's true. Human trafficking.
Mm-hmm. And they got the way it means nowadays to track a container. They are automatic readers. They can read the identification of the container. They can track that container in real time, where the hell is that, where it started, and where it ends.
Right. Well, that's an important job, for sure.
Then you have to have it insured.
Yeah.
There's insurance companies that insure your container load. You want it to be insured from the factory to the ship, travel, offloaded and loaded to its and brought to its destination. That's the kind of insurance you want to have.
Yeah, I can hear it, because if a ship tips over on the way over, I imagine.
And
that
if you, if like that guy there was talking about in that lecture, you got to hire somebody on land to make sure that the things you're getting is to your specification.
Right.
That the quantity is being loaded on the container. And you want to put your lock on the container. And when it comes to the it arrives here in the United States, U.S. Customs may want to examine it. They'll have you unload everything in that container so they can examine and see exactly what's in there.
Right.
If it's dutiable, you got to pay a duty tax when it comes in. Depends on what it is. If you're bringing gold in, if you're bringing raw nature gold, they don't put no duty on it. But if you're bringing gold rings and watches, they put a duty on it because it's competing against American made.
Right. Well,
my custom broker agent, his name is Mr. Kidd, K-I-D-D. It might be some more blacks now, but it wasn't, you know, some years ago. I forget the company that I had to use. I can't never bring, it to the tip of my tongue.
And there's a lot of opportunity here, obviously, but we got more of us have to get in the game. That's why I'm so glad you sent it, and that's why I played, there's five of them. I think I played all five. And added one more in on top of that.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know what? I talked to Robin yesterday. She's recovering. She needs a vacation. So I think she's just resting up. But anyway, Pianchi, thanks for calling in. I'm going to end this one early today, so everyone have a good rest of the weekend.
At Jiffy Lube, we car about cars. In fact, we're kind of obsessed. That's why we've been taking car off business with quick quality oil changes and service for over 40 years. And with things like our Carful Vehicle Review, where our experts check, fill, clean, and inspect your vehicle, you'll know we'll car for your car like we car for our own. Jiffy Lube. Car more.
Visit JiffyLubeDC.com to find a Jiffy Lube service center near you.
The Virginia Lottery has three new Let's Make a Deal games, which means three ways to play your favorite game show. The Let's Make a Deal Print and Play has a top prize of $30,000. The Scratcher has a top prize of $100,000. And the online game could win you up to $500,000. Play Let's Make a Deal from the Virginia Lottery in stores, in the app, or online today. Visit VALottery.com/deal. Let's Make a Deal, licensed by Fremantle, all rights reserved.